George Peterson is going to introduce our speaker tonight. So without further ado, other than to remind you that if you haven't yet taken out your memberships, we'd very much like you to do so. I have the pleasure of calling upon the President of the University of British Columbia, Dr. George Peterson, who will introduce our speaker.
Thank you very much, Dick. It's a real honor to be asked to do the introduction this evening. But before I do so, I thought I would do something that isn't part of the program this evening. I've thought about it several times and have found it difficult to think when the appropriate occasion might be. I'm sure most of you are very well aware that putting together programs such as we get year after year at the Vancouver Institute is a very demanding assignment. Belle Nemetz has been doing this for a great many years, and at least on those occasions when I've come to these public meetings, there's never been an opportunity to recognize her. And I thought I would ask that you join with me this evening in the usual form and thank her for all those many hours. As I look out in the audience, it's very clear that our speaker this evening requires very little in the way of introduction. Many of you have long associations with this university, and there wouldn't be any way of having an association with the University of British Columbia without knowing Peter Larkin. He currently serves as an administrator. He's presently the Associate Vice President responsible for research, and under his leadership, there have been very dramatic increases in the research funding that's now flowing to this university. More important, really, in a sense, he is also a professor at this university. He is a part of the Institute of Animal Ecology and as well is a member of the Department of Zoology. He's been here since 1966. He served as a professor, he served as a head, he served as a dean, and he now is serving in the central administration. Prior to coming to the University of British Columbia, he also had held a variety of very important positions. I'm not going to go through all of them, other than to say one of the more recent ones prior to coming here was as director of the Pacific Biological Station at Nanaimo. He is a native of Auckland, New Zealand, and he told me, like Stephen Leacock, he decided to emigrate here at age 4 and his parents came along. Peter has had an absolutely brilliant academic career. He went to high school in Regina, and as the head of his graduating class and as the head of high school graduation in that province, he was the Governor General's bronze medal winner. He then went on, spent a year at Regina College, and from there went to the University of Saskatchewan, where he did a bachelor's degree and a master's degree, and he won the Governor General's gold medal there as well. He was the 1946 Rhodes Scholar from the province of Saskatchewan, went on to Oxford, completed a PhD there in 1948. He holds a great many honors, and this is not the occasion to go through all of them. I will cite a few, however. He is a fellow of the Royal Society of Canada. As well as that, he was a recipient of the Canadian Centennial Medal in 1967, the Queen's Jubilee Medal in 1977, and last year was the recipient of the American Fisheries Society Award of Excellence. He's a great teacher, well-renowned throughout this university, was a recipient of the Master Teacher Award from this university in 1971. In addition to his many on-campus activities, he carries on almost as many off-campus. Many of those are both in the private and in the public sector. Again, I give you just a few examples. He is a member of the board of BC Packers. He is currently on the council of the Canadian Institute for Advanced Research. He is on the editorial advisory board of the Canadian Journal of Zoology. He's just recently been appointed to the governing council of the Internet, or the, what's IDRC stand for? International Development Research Council. Thanks, Peter. He has had an active involvement with the National Research Council in Canada and also with the Science Council of Canada. As I indicated to you, those are but a few examples of the sort of activity that he's carried on. As well as that, he's managed to find time to write somewhat in excess of 120 scholarly papers. More important than any of the things that I've told you this evening, it's important that I tell you he's just a great guy and a great colleague. This university is very fortunate to have him. Would you please welcome Peter Larkin?
Put that around your neck. I carry you about the whole. There you go.
Thank you very much, Dr. Peterson. Dr. Peterson, Mr. Metz, Mr. Vogel, ladies and gentlemen, I know that all of you are very much aware that there's a great deal known about Pacific salmon and their biology. And I also know that many of you already know that Pacific salmon undertake outstanding migrations here in the nearby Pacific Ocean. Every year, tens of millions of salmon find their way back to the stream in which they were born. Only a very few go astray. Just a few thousands of those several tens of millions ever fail to get home. And for over a century, biologists have wondered, how do they do it? Well, tonight, I'm going to briefly tell you in a somewhat romantic way what we think we know about where they go and how they find their way home. Then, at the end, if you ask the right questions, I'll tell you what we think we might find out in the future and what we'll do with it. With that brief introduction, I think I can say that I only need to add one more thing. For those of you who, like Dr. Peterson, like an executive summary, because they have a lot to think about, the answer to the question, how do the salmon find their way home, is, we don't know. But we've got a few clues, and what we do know is just simply fantastic. So, on with the romance.
Some of them are having difficulty hearing you.
All right.
That's salmon. Right.
Well, the first thing we should do, I think, is to remind ourselves just what it is that these salmon do. This is a lake called Johansson Lake, which is at the headwaters of the Sustut River, which is one of the most northerly tributaries of the Babine and Skeena system. Johansson Lake is 600 kilometers from the sea. It's at an altitude of almost 2,000 meters. And about 6 weeks or so ago, at the outlet of the lake, there were these sockeye salmon that had come a distance altogether during the course of their life of several tens of thousands of kilometers. They had been out in the ocean going round and round for several years, and they started back to Johansson Lake from somewhere out south of the Aleutians. It's truly an incredible performance, and it's a natural spectacle that is on a world scale. Now, I might begin by giving you a little feeling for some of the history of theories about how salmon find their way home. When I first came to University of British Columbia in 1948, the authority on where salmon went when they went to sea was Dr. Clemens. And Dr. Clemens had been director of the biological station and was the head of the Department of Zoology here. And Dr. Clemens believed, as did most of the experts of the time, that salmon never went very far beyond the influence of the streams in which they were born. It was the prevailing belief that salmon never went more than 100 miles or so from shore. And although it wasn't very clear what the influence of the river was that they were supposed to be sticking around to, it was nevertheless firmly believed that the salmon never went very far away. And then, shortly after World War II, when it was still a mystery how far out to the sea the salmon went, both from our coast as well as from Alaska and the USSR and Japan, Japanese fishermen began to fish further and further away from the island of Hokkaido. There's Hokkaido. And Japanese fishermen began fishing more and more out to sea, further away from Japan and further away from the Kamchatka Peninsula, out toward the end of the Aleutian chain and out toward the international dateline. These Japanese fishermen were getting bigger and bigger vessels and more of them, and they were going further and further to sea, fishing with these very, very large gill nets. And it didn't matter how much further they went, how much further they went out from Japan and over toward the North American coast, they kept on catching salmon. Well, as you can guess, the island of Hokkaido produces a relatively small number of salmon compared to how many are produced by Russian streams, and also a very few by comparison with Alaskan streams. So many people in both the USSR and the United States and Canada began to worry that perhaps the Japanese were catching fish that would have otherwise come home to our streams. Now, the Russian answer to this was fairly direct. They announced that in that whole area on their side of the ocean, they were going to be carrying out maneuvers, which is a diplomatic way of saying that if we see any of your cotton-picking fishing boats out there, we're going to have target practice. The United States and Canada approached Japan about a treaty, and the International North Pacific Fisheries Convention was signed by the three countries. And one of the things that that treaty required was that the three nations should attempt scientific studies that would delineate the migrations that were undertaken by salmon from the different countries on the high seas. Those studies involved catching a lot of fish on the high seas. And in order to catch fish on the high seas, you've got to be careful that you don't damage them. And the best way of catching them is not with a net, but rather to catch them on a hook and line. And to catch fish on the high seas and to put a tag on them so you can find where they eventually turn up, you use what is called long line gear. What you do is about 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, just before it's dawn, you put out about 10 miles of string, which floats on the surface, and about every 5 or 10 yards along the string, you hang a little leader, and on the end of the leader is a little hook, and on the hook is a little dried anchovy. You lay this out at about 3 o'clock in the morning, and when you get all the way down to the end of your 10 miles or so of string, you go back down to the beginning, and you start picking it up again. This is around 7 o'clock. And if you've chosen a good place, you'll get about 300 salmon for every 1,000 hooks, which is pretty good fishing. What happens is that the salmon have their food organisms silhouetted against the surface, and they come up to the surface and snatch them first thing in the morning at first light. So it's a great way of catching fish. Well, using this technique largely, and putting tags on fish and seeing where they went, and other studies like that, there has emerged some rather startling information. One is that salmon from the Asian coast will come well over into our side of the ocean, well across the international dateline. And salmon from British Columbia and from Alaska will go well over toward the Asian side of the ocean, also going across the international dateline. Right now, right this minute, those salmon that are going to be coming back to the Adams River in October of 1986 are right there. Or there. Or there. But they're out there. Not only that, we've been able to piece together the migration routes that these salmon follow. Now, I'm only going to show you some of these, just a few, to give you the general idea. This diagram shows the migration in the ocean of pink salmon. And it's the simplest migration of all of the species of salmon. These animals live for only 2 years. They are born, they're deposited as eggs in streams all up and down our coast in September or October. In the following spring, they emerge from the gravel and they stream down the rivers into the Strait of Georgia, into Hecate Strait, and then they join a generally northward movement along the coast, a northwesterly movement along the coast, which is very rapid. During the summertime, this is almost like, in the spring and early summer, this is like a conveyor belt with literally tens of millions of young pink salmon moving very rapidly northwest. They are going with the current, and they know it, and they head downstream and go faster than the current. So that if you set a net with its arms open, facing the current, you'll catch a very large number of little pink salmon. But if you turn the net around so that it faces the other way, you don't get any. So there's no doubt about it that the salmon are going downstream, they're going with the stream, and they know it. They move along about 10 to 12 miles a day. About now, the pink salmon that came out of the Fraser River back in the spring would be here. And during the next few months, they'd move further south. And during the winter, they'd repose in this very, very large area off the British Columbia, Oregon, and Washington coast. They spend the winter here, and then in the spring, they go directly home. And I want to underline that. They go directly home. They don't say, let's go back the way we came and go around like that. They say, let's go home, and they go straight home, just like children are supposed to do from school, straight home. Now, we can demonstrate this in a very convincing way. If you put tags on pink salmon out here, and then you recapture them up here, you know exactly how many days it was between when they were here and when they were there. It's well known that fish can swim at a steady rate, a certain number of body lengths per second, generally a little over 2 lengths per second. If a fish is 2 feet long, he's going to be able to swim 4 feet per second and keep it up for a long time. Well, if you know how many days it took him to go from here to there, and you know how fast he is capable of swimming on a sustained basis, it's very easy to figure out that they don't waste any time. They must go by a virtually direct route in order to make it home. Notice one other thing. For many of these lines that are drawn in here, these aren't lines that are drawn with just artistic license to look pretty. They're, as far as possible, meant to depict what we think happens or what we know happens. And you'll notice that in many instances, these lines turn like this, just at the end. I'll come back to the significance of that movement toward the end of my remark. But remember, it's really quite important. So, the general picture that we have for the migration of pink salmon on this side of the ocean is a huge counterclockwise movement, and then a direct migration home and a little turn at the end. Now, how do you think they do it on the Asian side of the Pacific? Do you think they go clockwise over there? Well, no, they don't. They go counterclockwise over there, too. And the fish come out of the streams along the shore of Kamchatka. They get caught up in the Kuroshio current. They come barreling down the coast of Kamchatka. They do exactly the same sort of thing as they do on the other side of the ocean, off here in the fall, move down into their wintering grounds. And then come the early spring, early summer, they go straight home, right through the passes of the Aleutians in a beeline, a direct route home. Well, that's the simple migration. The pink salmon, as I say, just do one loop in the ocean. Their whole life cycle is only 2 years. But for sockeye salmon, which spend 2 or 3 years at sea, there is a very much more complicated annual migration involved. For instance, this is how sockeye salmon from Babeen Lake move. They come out of Bristol, sockeye salmon from the Bristol Bay lakes move. They come out of Bristol Bay, they come down through the Aleutian Passes, they go into the Gulf of Alaska, and then in the wintertime are down here. In the springtime, they go way over toward the other side of the ocean. In the middle of the summer, they come back this way. Then in the wintertime, they're over here again, or down here again, and so on. So every year, they're going around in this kind of a loop. And then, after spending 3 years at sea, when they're in the springtime over here, they turn, come directly through the passes of the Aleutians, and go straight to Bristol Bay. That's a very complicated marine migration. Well, there have been a lot of theories, and a lot of experiments have been undertaken to try and account for how salmon are able to undertake these incredible migrations at sea and find their way home. Strangely enough, one of the most significant clues was, first of all, resulted from research in fresh water, and it concerns the salmon's nose. Everybody notices the nose of the salmon and how it's all hooked, and it all enlarges at the time that the animals are spawning. Matter of fact, the scientific name for Pacific salmon is Oncorhynchus. An onco means hooked, and rhynchus means nose. So the proper, if you're a scientist, the proper name for this animal is not a salmon, it's a hooked-nosed fish. And it's a very appropriate name, because that nose is not only a decoration, but it also is a very significant element in how salmon find their way home. By a lot of different experiments, it has been demonstrated that at least once salmon are in fresh water, they smell their way home. Now, when a salmon is out off the west coast of Vancouver Island, he doesn't smell the Adams River. It's a lot better system than that. What they do is they memorize the odors that they smell as they go out, and then they pick them up in reverse order as they come back. So, when they hit the Strait of Juan de Fuca, they go, Fraser River, I got it, I remember that. They swim up the Fraser River, and when they get to the, just past Boston Bar, there's the Fraser River, and there's the Thompson River, they go, there's the Thompson River, I remember that. So they go this way instead of going that way. And they go up the Thompson River, and when they get to Kamloops, they sniff again, and they take the South Thompson rather than the North Thompson. And then when they get to Little Shuswap Lake, they say, I think I can smell Adams River. They go around the corner, and there they are, home. So they smell the odors that lead them home in the reverse sequence to, in which they were imprinted as they went out. Our understanding of this phenomenon has reached the point where now one can deliberately arrange to decoy salmon to some other place than where they were intended to go. You take the fish in the hatchery, you have fish in the hatchery, and you train them to the smell of a substance, an organic substance, like morpholine. They become accustomed to this, and when they go to sea, when they come back, if you, instead of having the morpholine at the hatchery, stick it 10 miles away, into some other river, why, they'll go to that other river because it smells of morpholine instead of going to the hatchery. So, for instance, you could raise fish in the Capilano hatchery, and if you wanted to, you didn't want them to come back to the Capilano River, where there's all kinds of troubles these days, why, you could just drip morpholine or whatever other substance you'd train them to, drip it into the Seymour River, and they'd go there instead. It's a very well established phenomenon now, and it's a major clue to how salmon find their way home. However, If you stop and think about it, suppose you're way up there near the Aleutians. I mean, do you really believe that a salmon way out there could smell the Fraser River as distinct from, say, the Columbia River or the Skeena River or any other river? I mean, I don't believe it. Not for a minute. So there must be something else. And the real question is, what else is there? What other way could they find their way home? Well, some people, some of the early theorists, argued something like this. They said, well, the salmon won't go where it's too cold. I mean, they won't go up to the North Pole. So they'll obviously, when it's too cold, turn south. And you never see them around Hawaii. So they obviously don't like it when it's too hot. So that boxes in the part of the ocean that they're going to be found in. And then if they just bang around at random, you know, ride off in all directions at once, so to speak, you know, swim over here, swim over there, swim over here, eventually, some of them are going to find their way home. Some of them will get lost, but some of them will find their way home. Well, that's a pretty primitive theory. And there's no evidence that that is an acceptable theory. All the evidence we have points to the fact that they go home, and they do so by going in a beeline, and there's no evidence at all that suggests that there are salmon that swim around out there and die because they can never find fresh water at the time that they should be going to spawn. So there must be some other factors involved. Well, the next clue in how salmon might find their way home came from studying the fish in fresh water. Now, these three kids are standing near the outlet of Stewart Lake up near Fort St. James. Now, if you imagine that you're a little tiny salmon that's only 3 or 4 centimeters long, that's quite a formidable place to find your way out of. And for a small salmon, one of their first problems in navigation is how do you find your way out of the lake in order to get to sea? Dr. Groot at the biological station did some very important studies on young sockeye salmon in Babine Lake. And what he discovered was that these young salmon, and since been demonstrated for many other young salmonid fishes, are able to orient very accurately by having a view of the sky. They are sensitive to the plane of polarization of light in the sky, in addition to which they can tell by the position of the sun which way they should be going. They can also pick out landmarks. They jump out of the water and they see something that's familiar, they can orient by that. So that these animals are by no means dumb. They are really quite clever when it comes to using what are called celestial cues to give them some idea of the direction in which they should go. This immediately suggested that perhaps celestial navigation might be the way in which salmon were finding their way home from way out near the Aleutian Islands. The sort of thinking was that, well, if you're a sailor, for instance, in an old-time sailing vessel, you used to have two clocks. One clock was set at Greenwich Mean Time, and the other clock you set every day by shooting the sun, finding out when the sun was at its zenith, and then you'd set your local clock. And then by looking at the difference between the local time and Greenwich time, you knew what your longitude was. And if you had a calendar so that you knew what the date was, and you could shoot the angle of the sun, you knew what your latitude was. So, if a fish can look at the sky, all he's got to do is have as much brains as Christopher Columbus or somebody like it, and he ought to be able to figure out how to do it. Okay. Now, the essentials, as I just zipped through that, the essentials are that you have to have certain kinds of information if you want to get to the right place at the right time. Let's say I invite all of you to come and have a drink with me. What's the first thing you say? You say, thanks. When? Okay? So I say, tomorrow, 5 o'clock. Goodbye. And you say, hold it. Where do you live? And I say, east of here. Goodbye. You say, hold it. How far? You see, because you have to know how far east I am, and you have to know what time it's going to be, and you have to know where you are so that you know when to leave in order to get to my house in time. Okay? So once I tell you my house is east of here and it's 10 miles and it's 5 o'clock, you know that if you're going to make it, you're going to leave your house at 3 o'clock. Okay? So to get, you see, the salmon has essentially the same problem. He's got to get to the spawning grounds on time. I mean, there's no sense whatever in a salmon turning up 2 months early or 2 months late. He's got to be there at the right time. Okay? And to do this, he has to have a clock and a map and a compass. And these are the essential ingredients for celestial navigation. And for some time, people believed that it was by some such scheme as this that salmon were able to find their way home. However, it turns out that although you can tell the time easily enough by these celestial cues, just by the change in day length, it's no way in which you can find your way home when you're out near the Aleutian Islands. Because at the time of the year when the salmon should be leaving there to find their way home, the days on which there is cloud cover or fog are better than 90%. So anyone who's using celestial navigation from the Aleutian Islands in early spring or summer has got a pretty tough road to hoe. This then has meant that people have had to look at some other kinds of theories. And it's been an exciting last 10 or 15 years as people have looked at other possible ways in which salmon could find their way home. One of the early ideas, and it probably came from people playing around with computers quite a bit 15 or 20 years ago. One of the ideas was that maybe these fish had a system like submarines do, that have what are called inertial guidance systems for telling them where they are. The idea is that by some weird and wonderful mechanisms, and if this sounds vague to you, that's exactly the right impression it should create, because the theories were all vague. By some unknown mechanisms, the fish were recording their displacement and keeping track of where they had gone, and eventually, when they were ready to come home, could figure out what direction they had to go in order to make it back home. It's a fanciful idea for which there has never been very much evidence. Another set of clues came from a very large body of anecdotal evidence that suggested, and some very good scientific evidence actually, that suggested that fish were very sensitive to electrical and electromagnetic fields. For instance, many of the local fishermen here in BC have tried out such things as putting an electric charge on their fishing line. They believe that that's one way of getting a greater number of fish. There are others that believe that it's important to take the charge off your boat because it will frighten fish. And like all fishermen's anecdotes, there's always a little grain of truth in them. It's now well known that many species of fish are highly sensitive to electric fields. Let me give you an example. When you have a current like the Gulf Stream, which is a very large mass of water moving across the surface of the ocean, when that large body of water passes through the Earth's magnetic field, what happens is there is a difference in potential between the two sides of the Gulf Stream. It's as though by moving through the Earth's magnetic field, an electric current was generated, which passes from one side of the Gulf Stream to the other. Now, if you take that difference in potential and divide it by the distance from one side to the other, and then see what fraction, how much difference in potential there would then be across the width of a salmon's head, and then try that difference of potential on the salmon to see if he reacts. He will. So, it has been demonstrated for shad and for salmon that they can tell whether or not they're swimming downstream or upstream when they're way out in the middle of the ocean. As long as there's a current, they will know that they are in it. This led to some more speculation about how salmon might find their way home. But there's always a cautionary note. Just because the animal can do something doesn't necessarily mean that that's what he will do in order to find his way home. For instance, you may find out that I can walk on my hands. But that doesn't mean to say that I come to work every morning walking on my hands. Okay? So salmon can detect that they're in these gradients, electrical gradients, but whether they use that knowledge to help them find their way home has never been very well documented or even very well substantiated. Well, that leads then to a rather exciting possibility which has developed very much in the last 3 or 4 years, related to the ability of salmon to react to electrical fields is their ability to respond to magnetic fields. If you take young sockeye salmon, for example, and you place them in a natural magnetic field, they will have a tendency to point in a direction that is appropriate to get them where they want to go. So that, for instance, if you take fish from Baby Lake and you put them in a natural magnetic field, deprive them of a view of the sky, deprive them of any opportunity to see landmarks, they'll still point in the direction of the outlet of Babine Lake. That's the way they should go if they want to go home. If they want to go out to sea. Similarly, if you take fish that are at sea, you put them in a natural magnetic field, they will show a tendency to go in a particular direction. Now, this can be very convincingly demonstrated by taking young fish, putting them in a natural magnetic field, seeing which direction they tend to point, then depriving them of the magnetic field, put them in a zone where you have screened out the Earth's magnetic field, and you will observe that they lose their orientation. They just go this way, that way, or whatever way. And then if you put them in an artificial magnetic field, in which you have put the natural north now in the wrong place, you've turned it round, okay, then the fish will point in a direction that is appropriate to the artificial north that you've created. So that there can be no doubt that salmon are able to orient in magnetic fields. And a considerable quantity of work has been done. One of the surprising things about this is how incredibly sensitive it is. One of the ways that we tag fish nowadays is instead of the old clumsy business of sticking a pin through the fin at the back and a little celluloid disc at the end, we don't do that anymore. We get an itty-bitty piece of magnetized wire. This looks like a piece of pepper in your hand. And you stick it in the cartilage in the salmon's nose. Okay? Now, you'd think that you got a little tiny bit of magnetized wire and you stuck it in the salmon's nose, that it might disturb their ability to detect direction in the Earth's magnetic field. Not a bit of it. Doesn't bother them at all. No effect, even when you put a little tiny magnet in their nose. It's even more surprising when you know where the magnetic sensing ability of the salmon lies. Because, you guessed it, it's up near the head. And where do you think it is? It's in the dermatomoid bone up near the nose. So that hooked nose is not only a decoration, It's not only used for smelling, but it's also the site of the natural compass that salmon carry. Now, thanks to Dr. David Jones of the Department of Zoology, had an opportunity to read in the last week a soon-to-be-published book chapter that brings up to date the story of magnetic responses in fish. It's one of these things that we're learning more about as the months and years go by. At the present time, it's believed, it's fairly well established, that the ability to respond to magnetic fields is concentrated in this dermethmoid bone, which is up near the front of the fish's head. It is centered in about 100 million cells, and inside each one of the cells in this region of the nose, there is a tiny crystal of magnetite. It's like a little free-floating compass needle that can respond by going up and down to the inclination of the Earth's magnetic field and swinging around and around to respond to the declination in the Earth's magnetic field. Now, how all of these little 100 million needles wiggling around each inside a cell then do something that the salmon responds to and that his brain integrates, nobody yet knows. If you want to speculate, you might say it's as though the salmon, if he's pointed in the right direction, feels great. But if he starts to veer off, then he gets a sinus headache on this side. There must be some sensory information that the animal gets that tells him that he's on course. But it's truly a remarkable phenomenon. And within another 5 or 10 years, we may have a much better knowledge of just exactly how this extraordinary system works. Let's go back and just think again about our latitude and longitude. If salmon really are navigating by some sort of magnetic sense, it has to be sufficient to tell them not only which direction to go, but it has to somehow or another convey information that tells them where they are. It must give them some sort of a map sense. So it requires that just as there is latitude and longitude, when we draw lines on the Earth's surface, there should be some sort of a bi-coordinate system of that kind when it comes to magnetic cues. And that is indeed the case. These lines show the changes in inclination of the Earth's magnetic field, how much the little needle would dip, and these lines show the declination, how much it would wiggle from side to side. If you superimpose this one and that one, you can imagine it makes a rough series of squares, a bi-coordinate system that could be used as a basis for navigation. The most recent theory published contained these two diagrams as the bi-coordinate system on which the magnetic organ, whatever it is, bases its map and compass system in order to guide the migration home. There are a few other little refinements to add in. As you might expect, or as you might speculate, that this magnetic system might not be perfect. You might say, I just can't believe that they've got a magnetic system that they can start in the Aleutians and just zero in and hit the Fraser River right on the button. Because that means you've got a compass that's going to be accurate to less than 1 degree. I mean, it's just phenomenal. Okay? So there must be a few little forgiving features to such a system. Well, one of them was suggested by a fellow who was obviously from a university. I know he was from a university. He pointed out that when a number of fish have a relatively poor perception of which way to go, if they pool their perceptions, then statistically, they could, on the average, come up with a very accurate perception. Now, I can see that there are doubting Thomases. So let me try something on you. Please do as I say. Point to downtown. Point downtown, now. Point downtown. Point downtown. Come on, more. Point downtown. Point downtown. See? Okay, now what happens? What happened? See, when I ask you to point downtown, there are a fair number of you that are really confident. You go like that, see? And there are others, you look around, see what others are doing. You start this way and you go that way. And pretty soon, if I ask three or four times around, you'd all be pointing to downtown. You'd all have it right. Okay? Well, the real trick then is if salmon are doing something like this, if they're pooling their perceptions of the long line, you can get fish that are, some are going to Alaska, some are going to BC, some are going to Japan, and some to Russia. So if they're going to pool information, they've got to be able to pool it with the right person. There's no sense asking a Russian fish which way should I go when he wants to go the opposite way to you. Okay? So how does a fish from the Adams River know another fish from the Adams River? Well, if you believe, as I do, that fish can smell their way home all the way from the Strait of Juan de Fuca to the Adams River spawning grounds, I don't find it difficult at all to believe that right out in the middle of the high seas that an Adams River fish can smell another Adams River fish. So I think that what happens is that there is a fair amount of recognition of your relatives going on just before these fish start their migration and during the course of their migration. Well, that's speculation. Let's just turn to a couple of other little things. You know, I told you early on about the pink salmon and how they turn right just before they're going to complete their migration. Well, this is characteristic of a lot of salmon migrations, that they don't hit the Strait of Juan de Fuca right bang on the button. They hit the northern end of Vancouver Island and then dribble down the coast and then come around the corner. And this is characteristic of a lot of salmon populations, that they don't go straight to their stream. They hit the coast well to one side or the other. And this is also characteristic of the way in which a lot of primitive peoples navigate. If you're an Eskimo and you're on the Arctic coast and you want to go visit your brother who's out on an island and there may be a blizzard, the last thing that you ever do is aim directly at his house. You deliberately aim to one side. And then when you hit the island, you know which way to turn to get to your brother's house. You turn right. Because if you don't, and if you aim right at his house and you happen to go to the right, but you think it's to the left, then you've got to go all the way around the island before you get to his house. And by that time, you could be dead. So a lot of primitive peoples practice navigation by deliberately steering to one side and then knowing which way they have to turn. The fact that a lot of salmon migration is the same way is really very suspicious. Another thing is that people have speculated that salmon can also smell what it's like near shore. That as they approach the shore of the ocean, they can detect that it's different from the open ocean. And this may provide them with an additional clue. Let me now try and tie it all together into what you might call a composite theory of the way in which salmon might find their way home. What I've told you about is a number of their different capabilities. The real question is which of those various capabilities do they use in order to find their way home? And it may work something like this. In the first place, a salmon is not going to go to a place that's too hot or too cold. So if he wanders into hot water, he turns north. And if he wanders into cold water, he turns south. That's pretty obvious. That's not difficult. He checks the sun angle and the change in the length of the day, and with this information he calculates if the time is ripe for him to take off, and if he wants to get there on time to spawn. And if it isn't the right time, well, then he stays, and he just does this as a daily routine, just checking out where he is, what the date is, until finally there is that combination of time, of events, that tells him now's the time for him to head off home. He takes a magnetic compass bearing. Having taken, I'm going to assume that you got to, if you're a fish, you got to think a little harder to take a compass bearing than to look at the sky. That's like most of us. You know, you're out in the woods, you look at your compass, you say it's going to go north, you say, oh, it's right toward that mountain. You don't look at the compass again unless you lose sight of the mountain. Okay, well, let's say the fish do the same thing. So, take a magnetic compass bearing, look at the sky and set a course, and start swimming at a steady speed. You get confused. Go back, take another compass bearing, right? So you get a nice little loop. And this will get you closer and closer to the coast. You can pick up a few friends and join a group. Then you can smell the shore and turn right. And then pretty soon you smell the Fraser. Then you smell the Thompson. Then you smell the Adams. And then you're home. And then you give a copy of the program to the offspring and away it goes again. Well, I think I should just add one or two last comments. Many of you here will know that there has been a tremendous amount of research done on birds, particularly on homing pigeons, but also on all sorts of other migrating birds. And those studies have been an immense stimulus to the way, to what we know about how salmon might find their way home. As a matter of fact, those of you who know a lot about bird migration will recognize that most of what I've been saying applies in somewhat similar form to what we know about how birds navigate. It's a hierarchical system in which there are several different sensory mechanisms involved. It's known that pigeons are affected by magnetic fields, that they can steer by them. The great advantage the pigeon has, of course, is that he can get a lot better view of the landmarks. But I like to think, even though the work on pigeons largely opened the way for the work that was done on fish, I like to think of it the other way around. Fish had it first. And fish evolved into reptiles, which when you stick a few feathers on them, are birds. So it was an invention of the fish, which the birds wisely decided to retain. Finally, for those of you who are not very good at directions yourself, if you're out fishing and you get lost and you catch a fish, ask him which way to go and turn him loose. I'm sure most fish can do a better job of navigating than most of us can. Before I conclude, I want to say just a few things. I want to say three little thank yous. First, I wanted to say thank you to my graduate students who keep me up to date. And if there's something in my talk that was not up to date, it's their fault. Second, I'd like to thank my assistant, Helen Hahn, who prepared all these delightful cartoons. And third, I'd like to thank my wife, who had to listen to all this already once this afternoon.
Now we're ready for questions. With or without cartoons. Sir?
The spell of the Thompson and the Fraser River must have changed considerably in the past 50 years. Does the fish compensate for the odors?
The rivers of origin have undoubtedly changed their odors over the last years. What's your theory about that in terms of fish compensation?
Well, I don't think the fish are memorizing a particular odor that's associated with the Thompson River. What they're memorizing is the odor that they smelled when they were going out to sea in the Thompson River. So that if the Thompson River odor changes, then so will whatever odor is imprinted on the minds of the young salmon. What they're smelling is what they experienced when they went down. You would worry if there was a drastic change in the odor of the river between the time the young ones went to sea and the time the adults came back.
Yes?
Dr. Larkin, you talked about the compass, if I can put it that way. And what are your speculations about the clocks? How do they know it's time?
In the two devices, the clock and the compass, how do we know about their clocks, about in terms of the time to return?
That's something that has been researched fairly extensively on a large number of vertebrates and invertebrates over many, many years. And the pineal organ in the top of the head and the pituitary gland are intimately involved in the whole mechanism of responding to the change in the photoperiod. So that in general, it's exactly the same mechanism that makes your apple tree decide when to put out flowers and produce apples, and which makes deer mate in the fall and so on. It's associated with the whole photoperiodic rhythm and the change in day length. So I think that mechanism is fairly well understood. There is a little enigma which is concerned with some of the salmon will come home after being 2 years at sea, others come home after being 3 years at sea, and others, so on. And what distinguishes the one group from the other, what makes some of them come home a year sooner than the other, has still not been adequately explained.
Yes, sir.
You've seen in underwater movies the way a whole school of fish will turn together. Now, how do they communicate this signal to each other instantly?
How do fish maintain convoy discipline? Is that it?
I hope I can get this right. There's an article about this in the Scientific American within the last year and a half, and it was written by a young fellow who had been an honor student here before he went off to do his graduate work. And as I recall, it partly involves the eye and seeing the other fellows. And it partly involves the lateral line. You know that line that goes down the side of the fish? Well, it's a pressure receptor, and it tells the fish when they're getting too close together. So it's a combination of the lateral line and visual cues that get them into that drill of all being able to move together and hold convoy formation, as Mr. Vogel says. I'm not sure I've got it right, but if you, as I say, there is a good article in it in the Scientific American about 2 years ago.
Well, it's no accident. It's not accidental.
No.
Tony?
How do the little ones get out of the lake?
How do they get out of the lake?
Well, they almost certainly use the same sort of cues, same sort of sensory mechanisms that the adults use. But there are some funny twists. For example, if you have a nice, simple, straight lake, then when you get the fish you'll find that they have a bias for going in the right direction to get out. But Babine Lake, if you know it, has an arm, so that the lake is shaped like a Y. Now, the little fish that live in this angle of the Y will show a strong preference to head in this direction for the first 10 days of their migration, and then they show a strong preference for heading in that direction for the remainder of the time. Now, what switches their preference from wanting to go this way to go that way is really mysterious. Another example is up here at Weaver Creek, where we have a spawning channel. in which those young fish will come downstream from Weaver Creek and then go upstream into Harrison Lake. And those fish, too, show exactly this kind of preference in magnetic trials for going this way, and then after a certain length of time, for going that way. So they must have built into them some sort of mini clocks, if you like, that are keeping track almost on a daily basis in order to guide their life history in the early part of their life. That's a very good question, and it's a hot one right now in people's research. Yes?
Bill? Do the fish pick up their directions going out or coming back as a consequence of water streaming? Is that it, streaming of the water itself?
Well, if you have a lake that is relatively small and a relatively large river coming in and going out, yes. A good example is Nilkitqua Lake, which is a small lake downstream from Babine Lake. It's got a big river coming in and a big river going out. So for the little fish that come in to Nilkitqua Lake, or for the ones that grow up, it's like living right next to the subway. I mean, they don't have to do anything. Just jump on and away they go and follow the mob. But for a large lake, like Babine Lake, you know, it's, what, 80, 100 miles long or something, or Stewart Lake or Takla Lake, on which the inflow is a whole bunch of little creeks, it's quite an undertaking for the fish to detect where the outlet is until they're really quite close to it. And then, of course, yes, they have a chance of doing it.
I'll go to the back. Is there somebody in the back? Yes?
Some salmon from Japan, as well as salmon from BC, have been introduced in Chile. Would Professor Larkin tell us what is his speculation as to their disorientation in the southern Pacific?
I think everyone heard that question.
Oh, well, that's a great question. That's another thing that's very timely, because a number of attempts have been made to introduce salmon into other parts of the world. And at the moment, there's quite a bit of talk and quite a bit of discussion and a few trials going on in trying to put salmon into Chile, the Falkland Islands, other parts of the southern hemisphere. Now, you know, I pointed out to you that in the North Pacific here, in both instances, the fish are going in a counterclockwise direction. Now, to some extent, those migrations are assisted by the way in which the currents move. Now, if you recall your South American geography and oceanography, there's a very large current coming up the coast of South America called the Humboldt Current, which carries all the way up to the equator, and would almost certainly take the young salmon into much warmer water than would be appropriate. If there were a current going in the other direction and they were to go south and they get into the Antarctic, the predominant current around the Antarctic is a circular one going around and around like this. So that if the salmon were to go south of South America and get onto that merry-go-round, they've got to be at the right stop at the right time if they're going to go home to spawn. So it's a question of how long it takes to go once around on the merry-go-round in the Antarctic, if you follow me. And if you were south of South Africa at the time that you wanted to spawn over in South America, it wouldn't be all that good. So there is a lot of speculation that the pattern of ocean currents may not be appropriate for those species of salmon that go the furthest in their migrations, such as pink salmon, chum salmon, sockeye salmon. The ones that are most likely to transplant are the coho salmon and the chinook salmon, because they tend to stay much closer to shore. And that's where most of the emphasis is being placed on the transplants to Chile at the present time. There were a number of attempts many years ago to introduce salmon into New Zealand streams. The only ones there that have stayed and that have established populations are the chinook salmon. And it's believed that they don't go very far away from the New Zealand coast, for the same reasons that it would be difficult, perhaps, to introduce salmon into some of those streams of Chile. It would be difficult to introduce them into the streams of New Zealand. But in the last analysis, you know, the salmon are going to be the best judge. And my feeling is it never pays to underestimate animals. So my belief is that we should go ahead and try a lot of things and see what happens. And I'd be fairly confident that the salmon will come up with a success story. And, you know, we wouldn't have expected it, but after it happens, we'll all say, well, I'm not really surprised. You know, that's the way we expected it would work out.
I'll take one in the back again. Yes, over here.
I understand that some studies have been done with the stars of planetaria. Are there any conclusive results of these experiments?
In terms of the astral aspects, there have been experiments done in planetariums. Are there any comments you'd like to make to that point?
I don't know of any work that's been done in planetaria with fish. Certainly it's been done with birds, and certainly birds get a lot of signs from the night sky. There has been some speculation that fish may be able to get some information from the moon, both the phase of the moon and its position in the sky. But that's still in the realm of speculation.
Are there any good biological reasons on why the salmon have to go back to the stream they come from for spawning? One would think that salmon would have a much enhanced possibility of survival if they could spawn anywhere. Are there any good biological reasons for that?
What is the biology of the fish having to return to the gravel of its native stream? And could we deal with the hatchery aspect as well?
Well, I guess the basic moral of returning to your home stream is there nothing succeeds like success. You're grown up. It worked. You know, you don't know your parents. They died when you were an egg and a sperm. Okay. You find yourself out in the ocean. It would make an awful lot of sense when you stop and think about it biologically. If you had to gamble, what would you do? Would you just take potluck? Or would you go to the place you came from? Well, the basic reproductive strategy of the salmon seems to be go to where you started, and that's the rationale behind it. However, there are some that don't. There are a few strays. And if you go back 10 or 15,000 years, the whole of our coast was covered with glaciers. So all the salmon that are in BC are relatively recent immigrants. They just come and colonized here. And they would never have been able to colonize British Columbia if they always went to their home streams. So for some of the salmon, the reproductive strategy is try something different. Okay? And that's how they manage to spread. And this is true of a lot of animals, that they're not all like peas out of a pod. They're all genetically a little different. There's some variability in the population, and under different circumstances, it's those that are colonizing that may wind up doing the best. I think that probably gives you the answer to the question. It's a very good question. Oh, a hatchery. Well, what about a hatchery?
Well, how do the breeding and hatchery... Can the chair ask a question? The breeding and hatcheries. Do the hatcheries all have gravels? I see pictures of the hatcheries in Oregon where they look pretty scientific to me.
Oh, well, you don't need gravel. You can make an artificial spawning ground. But this is very interesting. Raising juvenile salmon is just the simplest thing on earth. Any of you can do it. You don't need any instructions. You just take a female salmon, wait until she's ready to spawn, squeeze, the eggs come out, you take the male, squeeze, the sperm comes out, stick them in the water, stir them around, instant. That's it. And then you make sure that the water runs across them, and then after a while some of them hatch and they swim up, and then you give them little finely ground stuff to feed on, you know. Anything, liver, skim milk, mix it up, little pablum, doesn't really matter. They're really, really remarkably flexible little animals. And they're easy to raise. And this, incidentally, was why so many people figured over 100 years ago that, wow, hatcheries. You know, you just get an envelope out and you start figuring. A female salmon has 3,000 eggs, right? And I start with two, I'll get 3,000, and then they'll come back, Each of their 1,500 of them are females, and they'll have 3,000 eggs in no time at all. Especially when they all come back to the hatchery, you know. I mean, wow, you just figure you're going to have truckloads. Well, all kinds of people tried it, and they got terribly disappointed. They very frequently were able to raise the young salmon, plant them, and watch them go to sea, but then they'd never come back. There's dozens of reasons why they never did come back. We won't go into all of those. Suffice it to say that it's a lot, it looks easy, but it's really a lot more difficult than it looks to do it properly. I'm one of the great believers that now we know how to do it well and we can get some fantastic returns. I've been preaching for the last 10 or 15 years that I think we can double the number of salmon that we produce on this coast. I never get tired of telling people that for the last 10 years, the island of Hokkaido in Japan and its string of hatcheries has produced more pounds of chum salmon than British Columbia has produced of all five species of salmon put together. So, you know, really, there is a tremendous potential in hatcheries. Sorry for the sales pitch, but, you know, you asked me.
But that's an important aspect in terms of the conservation and preservation of the resource. Yes, right at the very back.
The magnetic ability is there right from the start. The experiments that Dr. Quinn has done have been on fish that have just barely hatched out of the egg. They're living still on their yolk that's in the egg. They're just starting to feed, and they have a sense of direction that's based on magnetism. So they have it right from square one.
We'll take a couple more. Yes? Are there breeding areas west of Kamchatka, and are they comparable to our cycles?
The Amur River is one of the great chum salmon producers of the other side of the ocean. The fish from the Amur River and the island of Sakhalin go to sea, migrating south of the tip of the Kamchatka Peninsula, and then they pick up the stream of the rest as they head down to their breeding or their feeding grounds way south of the Aleutians. Interesting, the Amur River runs have been decimated in recent years, and the Russians wish to rebuild the chum salmon populations of the Amur River. Each year, the Japanese pay the Russians a certain amount of money in order to catch fish that are headed for the Russian coast. The Russians are now using some of that money to hire Japanese hatchery specialists to develop populations of chum salmon on the Amur River. They're very good businessmen, the Japanese.
Now, you were going to tell us about what we might learn in the future.
Thank you. I would like to say just a word or two, perhaps the right thing to wind up talking about salmon for the evening. I think it's really exciting to take the sort of thing that we've been talking about tonight and project 40 or 50 years into the future and imagine how much more we'll know and how much more we may be able to manipulate things, and to project what kind of a world it'll be in the North Pacific with all these salmon in it. My guess is that 50 years from now, we'll not only know how salmon find their way home, but we'll be able to manipulate the parts of the ocean that they go to. I also speculate that the various countries bordering on the North Pacific will be having some very good arguments about the use of that community pasture out there. You see, all of our young salmon are well within the 200-mile limit off the Alaska coast when they're making their migration north. Similarly, there are a fair number of United States-bound fish that are using the marine resources that are inside our 200-mile limit. So one might guess that the sequel to the INPFC treaty may well be agreement amongst the several nations for how we should share that huge community pasture out there for salmon, and that what we'll be doing jointly is orchestrating through a wide range of hatchery techniques, we'll be orchestrating which species of salmon, which races of salmon are going to be using which part of the pasture in which month of the year, and we'll be bringing the total production of the North Pacific Ocean for salmon to its maximum. It's really exciting to speculate on the potential that there exists for producing more salmon once we master our understanding of how they find their way home and the techniques for genetically breeding the ones that we want to do what we want to do. It's an exciting prospect, and it's going to keep scientists busy for the next several decades, I can assure you.
Thank you. Before I call on Dr. Dennis Chitty to thank our speaker, I'd like to, if I could, Dr. Peterson, on behalf of the Institute, to thank you and the university for the support and the resource that we make use of. The idea of the Institute has gone on a long time. It's been very dependent on the University of British Columbia from its beginnings in 1916, and we couldn't replace what the university gives us if it weren't for the fact that you're there. Dr. Dennis Chitty, Professor Emeritus of the Department of Zoology, will thank our speaker on our behalf.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to have this opportunity of filling our president in on a few details of Dr. Larkin's life that he was perhaps not aware of. He's turned out all right, I must admit, but when he was at Oxford, he spent most of his time playing hockey, and when he wasn't playing hockey, he was playing cards with some rather shady characters in North Oxford, and he often stayed so late that in order to get into his college, which closed the doors at 12 o'clock, he had to go down through the coal hole in the sidewalk. Worse than that, sir, when he was first here, or shortly after he was here at the University of British Columbia, a very distinguished scientist came to visit. And when Dr. Larkin and a few of his fellow professors were seeing him off at the plane, they got a long chain and a padlock and a piece of bedroom furniture and shackled this to the wretched scientist and then put him on the plane, giving him the address of a locksmith in Amsterdam. Now, in spite of this doubtful, misspent youth, he has turned out rather well. And this brings me to one or two serious points I wish to make. First of all, I think it's very obvious that Canada, and especially BC, very much needs people of Dr. Larkin's expertise. We have a tremendous number of problems which require extremely detailed knowledge, and not only does he need to train, and has he not done a very good job, has he indeed done a very good job of training people who tackle these problems through his teaching, but also, as you can gather, he is able to funnel to us all kinds of knowledge from the international scene which we would otherwise have difficulty comprehending. Now, Dr. Larkin would be a far less valuable product if he had not had good opportunities, many of which are being denied to the current crop of students. For example, he had a very good undergraduate training, which enabled him, helped him perhaps to compete successfully for the Rhodes Scholarship. He was lucky enough to get a good summer's job in his field of biology. He then, of course, was lucky enough to be able to go abroad and study on the tradition of interchange between countries of our students. And finally, he was able to get funding for his work when he came back to BC. So in many ways, he was lucky to be growing up at the time he was, when the value of higher education was universally recognized as a good thing for this country. And we have to ask ourselves, what is going to be the situation in 30 or 40 years down the road Are we going to have the same opportunity to call on the talents of our young people? Now, of course, producing somebody of Dr. Larkin's expertise does cost money, but I hope you will agree with me and show it by your applause that this has been a particularly good investment.
I just remind you that Dr. Rod DeBell, who's the president of the Institute for Research on Public Policy, will be speaking to us next week on the topic economics and politics in British Columbia. He may well pick up on Dr. Chitty's points. And I invite you to join us, and I move the meeting adjourned, and thank you again, Dr. Larkin.